You're listening to the Surgeons of Horror podcast.
John Carpenter.
The Early Years.
Dark Star.
Okay, hello. Welcome to the second season of the Surgeons of Horror podcast. Its purpose is to look into the horror films, dissecting them one screen legend at a time. Our second horror legend and focus for the upcoming season is writer, director, producer, composer, John Carpenter. The idea is that we will look back into his career and the impact that he had on the horror film genre. In order to successfully do this, we need a team of horror aficionados who will form the surgical team each episode. So first up is yours truly, Paul Farrell, lead surgeon and host for the series of the podcast. I'm a self-confessed horror freak who grew up drawn to the dark work of the silver screen and threw myself into the arena, absorbing as much of the genre as possible with relish and glee. Joining me each episode at the Operating Theatre is a select team of horror aficionados who are at hand to perform the surgical task of dissecting each movie. With me this particular episode, I have lead surgical technician Ben Skinner. Welcome aboard.
Good morning slash afternoon.
Afternoon slash or whatever time it is that you're listening to us. And Ben's job is to literally get into the guts of the subject and offer his thoughts in the process. That's the team for this first one that we're going to go through. As I said, this is the John Carpenter Early Years Sessions, and our first subject is the first of his movies, which was Dark Star.
Dark Star, Dark Star.
And if Ant was here, he'd probably pull out the music and start playing in the background.
I don't actually... I was going to start humming it, but it's one of those ones that doesn't really stick in your
noggin.
It's not
a signature tune, but what we should emphasise is this is John Carpenter in his infancy, and this is where he's already showing his craft or his what he's become known as with his with his composing in his music towards the film score and the film in general.
It's almost like a garage band compared to like Pro Tools.
Yes.
Like that's kind of, or Ableton Live. Like that's the kind of leap that happens between this and what follows.
Absolutely.
But you can definitely hear it coming through.
And it's in, and I recommend people go and check it out too. You can actually listen to all of it on YouTube. I'll put a link on the bottom of this page about that too. But look, it's definitely worth listening to because it's an interesting one. And he's definitely topical at the moment. His film career kind of wavered, shall we say, in a polite way, towards the end of his career. But he's kind of found a new lease of life now on tour, doing a lot of the composing and of his music and stuff on stage, and it's going really well from the sound of things, getting quite a lot of rave reviews. He's, what's two albums into his original music as well.
Yeah, he works closely with his son.
Yeah.
They both got the musical bone, but I think he's accepted the fact that he's left it open that he might come back to film, but don't think he's particularly worried about it right now.
Interestingly, this year there was an announcement as well, we're recording this, we're now August in 2016. But interestingly, he's coming on board to help with the screenwriting for the Halloween remake, which can only be positive because, or you could argue that with me if you want, only because it'll be good to have someone original coming in from the original, setup of that franchise. To lend their voice to it, because I think that was the thing with Rob Zombie stuff is that you're lending it to a fan of the genre, and they've just been given free rein to kind of go off of it.
How he managed to get the approval. Like, was there any approval process involved?
I'm not sure. I mean, we're gonna do a look at the Halloween franchise, and Ben and I got the short straws of talking through the Rob Zombie movies when they come about. But that's due for we'll save that for another podcast discussion.
Yeah.
This is Dark Star. So those listeners that may be new to this podcast of Surgeons of Horror, the idea is that we start talking through, or I start talking through, the narrative or plot line of the film. My guest podcasters, basically interject and comment along the way. And then we throw in a few conversational bits about the players of the piece, actors, maybe a couple of people that lent their weight behind the screen, behind the camera. And then maybe our final verdict at the end before we round it out. So let's start talking about the movie. So we get like these intro graphics. There's an attention comms device from Earth to Darkstar. This is very kind of dated kind of stuff that we're looking at here. Very basic. What we should add is that it was a university project that came that was made for this movie.
I can sense that.
And yeah. It was originally like, say, for argument's sake, it was about 60 minutes long, and then they had to kind of beef it out a little bit when they realized that they could probably put it out as a feature release. So we're talking very minimal set design and stuff.
Very Red Dwarf.
Very Red Dwarf. Very good. Good analogy or association with it. Particularly early Red Dwarf as well.
Yeah.
So we have this video transmission come up. Basically, they're saying there's no funds and that, you know, certain doom lies ahead for them. We learned that the commander is dead, and that the spaceship, and where we get that kind of the spaceship looming into view with the graphics behind, you know, with the scenery behind it. And this is where the great score kicks in as well at this point. We're introduced to two characters, Pilbeck and Talby. And they're trying to have a communication with each other, but the comms link is poor. So again, kind of signs that, you know, they're pretty much flying by the seat of their pants a bit. Within this scenario, Talby sits in like, he basically spends most of the time at the beginning of the movie kind of sat in this kind of pod glass kind of thing at the top of the ship. He's come quite isolated from the group.
It's kind of like, obviously, it's very, again, he's getting across that idea that it's a very mundane job that just happens to be in space. Like any miner that's away from their family for long periods of time, eventually they just go a bit stir crazy spending all this time together.
And that's essentially what they're tapping into, and I think that's why it resonates so well. Especially, it's done like, it was originally penned. I should add here that it was penned by Dan O'Bannon, who would go on to do Alien.
Probably maybe shouldn't have like appeared in the film. But, now I understand you saying it's a student film, you know.
So obviously he plays Pilbeck.
I'm surprised
in it.
Carpenter, who often makes cameos in his films, didn't show up in this.
Oh, but he does.
He does?
Yeah, not physically. He does the voice of Talby.
I was thinking that.
He dubbed over Talby in it.
Spoiler.
Yeah. So so technically he's featured in some way.
But he's such a good looking man, why wouldn't he just back then, maybe not now. He looks like a decomposing corpse now, but anyway.
He's
rather harsh.
Lending himself to the art that he made his name to.
He's looking more and more he's like a zombie.
That's it. So we've got this character, interestingly, like he's become quite segregated from the other group, and he kind of spends most of his time just staring out into space. Marveling at the universe. There's a lot of philosophical conversation that happens throughout this movie too. We got the other three crew members kind of huddled in this small computer room, and then we kind of get an insight into what their job is, and that as they unload bomb number 19, Pilbeck talks directly to the bomb as though it's human. The bomb is dropped, and then force fields are engaged, and then the ship then light speeds away from the planet as the bomb descends. The planet then explodes, and the spaceship is at a safe distance from the explosion. Was that the sound effect of it exploding?
Yeah, I believe that's exactly how it sounded.
The crew evidently are sent out to destroy any unstable planets that they kind of consider unsafe.
We're told this by the female computer.
Yeah, that's right. So, like,
I am a computer.
Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to ask, is that Carpenter as well?
Doing a female voice? Yeah. I don't know. I don't think so. I don't even know if they were credited, whoever it was.
Yeah.
With that, though, there's this kind of a bit of a... I automatically think of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where, you know, they go around kind of blowing up planets
because
they deem them... In this case, it's because they want to have a highway to... in Galaxy. It's because they want to create a space highway.
Yeah, I think Mike Baird might have taken some inspiration.
Maybe.
That is an obscure reference that no one will get.
It's kind of that kind of same thing. And what I was going to say earlier was with Dan O'Bannon is that It was meant to be made out as a serious sci-fi film.
Yeah, and I didn't know. Yeah.
It ends up being more comedy, and that's what drew people towards it, particularly those of the university students.
Yeah, it's almost like a stoner film.
Very much so. And even so, because one of the characters is a surfer.
Yeah.
And not that those two things always go in alignment, but in some cases they do.
I think you could probably make a mistake, and I think I was in that mode initially of like, this is a serious film.
Yeah.
And then I gradually caught on that this can't, no. This is obviously being played for laughs. Absolutely. Surely.
But I don't think, that was never its intent. Yeah. It's just that's how it came about. So it's interesting.
Yeah, because you can't really, when you're living in the shadow of Star Wars and Alien and things this, like.
That's it.
Yeah.
So at this point, they've destroyed this planet. Boiler tells Doolittle that there was a 95% percent probability that there is intelligent life, and Doolittle isn't that interested. So they set course for another planet. So like you get this thing where the boiler's trying to look for, hey, there's potentially people we can kind of engage with here, but they're just out for just doing what they're supposed to do and destroying planets. While they wait for the arrival of the new planet that they're going to go and destroy, some music is played while we are treated to the open credits.
What's the music track?
This is one of the composed music tracks that has been put together by Carpenter.
So this isn't an original. This isn't like a track that he's found.
Right. No. This is all like everything in his original music, and even like there's a bit where I think the only one that's not is the bit where he goes. You know where Doolittle goes off and plays that with all the glass bottles and stuff. I think that's.
I
think that's not original. I think that was they used somebody. For that one.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the spaceship cruises through space while the crew mill around. We get the ship's kind of log narrated by the Doolittle character. He's the guy that's basically taken on responsibility of manning the ship.
And maybe a little bit hesitant to do so.
Yes.
Has a bit of confidence issues going on.
Definitely has confidence issues. And he's the surfer guy too. Mm. So he's always got his head in the waves. He's basically kind of again announces the ship's systems deteriorating. We have Pilbeck, you know, stressing that he's concerned about the fact that his seat is next to where the commander died. Again, a bit more of the comedy bit comes in there.
Yeah,
we get a bit more music coming in again. The ship's computer then notifies the area that the crew that an asteroid system is bound, and it causes an electrical asteroid field. Which is going to disrupt the computer, and the computer
like Pac-Man.
Yeah, that's it. The computer convinces the bomb that this was a mistake, because it sets off one of the next bomb to go out into the bay to be dropped. She eventually. So there's a weird thing where like we have computers and bombs that have human personalities, and they're talking to each other. The computer basically encourages the bomb that it's not meant to go off, and so it goes back into the bay. This is important because it kind of keeps happening throughout the movie. We also learned that the sleeping quarters had been blown up, so that basically the crew kind of sleep in the food storage area as a result.
Which is just adds to the terrible conditions and depressing nature of the ship.
And this is where they go down there for some time. They're clearly bored out of their minds, as you noted, Ben. Pilbeck kind of goofs around with a rubber chicken. This just pisses off Doolittle, and he then storms out and he goes into a room and plays some kind of instrument which is made entirely out of bottles, which I was talking about earlier. Pilbeck then kind of rests. Boiler seems a bit obsessed with twisting his tash at this point. He's got this killer 70s tash. Anyway,
I noticed the pictures on the wall of the naked women.
Yeah,
you can see it in the wide shot, but then when they cut to a close up, it's all blurred.
So what happens next? Doolittle then ventures to go and talk to Talby up in the glass pod. They seem to have a bit of a connection, these two.
They have a Kevin Smith-esque conversation.
They do. Yes, they do. Very good. And it's through this conversation we're told that Talby has become something of a recluse. He romanticizes about a glowing asteroid cluster known as the Phoenix Asteroids, And we also learned that Doolittle was something of a surfer back on Earth, and he misses being out on the waves. We then go to Boiler, who starts using a laser gun for practice. And this is kind of a good thing. I mean, not a good thing that he's doing, but it's a good thing in the sense that it heightens that sense of boredom. You just kind of want to just do something, and yeah. He just wants to blow shit up.
Because, it's yeah. Like, you know, it's the thing of like the guy that's looking after the nuclear silo, like, blowing up the whole world because.
Yeah, that's right.
What do you do? Idle hands.
Let's say how this world's going to go. It's going to be some dude just going, yeah.
Yeah, his name's Donald Trump.
That's him. Yeah. Can you imagine?
That's the guy.
Yeah. Anyway, the computer interrupts them, saying Pinback needs to feed the alien that's on board.
That's not a euphemism?
No, not at all. She reminds him that he insisted on keeping the alien as it was a good mascot.
Yeah,
and so he's kind of reluctant. He has to. Yeah,
like
this is where we see the alien in question. It's basically a beach ball with feet.
Yeah,
played by Nick Castle,
as in controlled.
By yeah, Nick Castle. Yeah, as in like he's inside the beach.
He's inside the beach ball.
Yeah,
I thought it was just someone off screen holding the beach ball.
No, he's kind of inside it, kind of squatted, jumping around. So Nick Castle is those who aren't familiar is the guy that would go on to play the Shape in Halloween. And direct The Last Starfighter.
That's right. We found this out recently.
We did. Pinback and the alien have this argument, and the alien escapes from the room. We get this kind of comedy scenario that kind of follows on from this, where, you know, Pinback goes to find it. This whole section was crowbarred in to lengthen the script from the short movie.
Yeah, so I was going to say, the minute you said that they had to find some running time, this is the first scene I thought of.
Yeah.
Because it just goes on way longer than you expect it to.
Absolutely.
And it's almost like it gets funnier as it goes along because it is so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the situation just becomes,
even more stupid. Yeah. That's right.
But you are just waiting for him to die, essentially. And it never happens.
No.
But you're like...
You think it's gonna always
you think it's just around the corner.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? When you're playing with boredom and you're playing with people that, and in particular with Pinback's character, we find out later on that he's not even meant to be a member of the crew. So it's kind of all this thing where, you know, he's kind of out of his depths completely. Mm. When you use that you're gonna be prone to mistakes happening, you know. And they're definitely not the fully fledged functioning team.
All it needs is just a Benny Hill soundtrack or something, you know?
Oh, for this one too. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, he's kind of chasing after this alien, and the alien climbs across the lift shaft. Pinback follows using a plank to climb across. He finds the alien in the emergency airlock, and it runs off and steals the plank, denying Pinback the chance to climb back across the lift shaft. So what does he do? He attempts to scale around the outside wall. The computer then turns on the lift shaft, and the alien starts to attack Pinback, who falls and just manages to hang on to the base of the lift. Despite this, the alien tries to tickle him. Oh, no, so he's trying to hang on. Sorry, I've jumped ahead. So he basically falls, and he's hanging on the edge of this kind of entrance bit into the lift shaft, and the alien starts to tickle him. The elevator then begins to descend, and it stops just at Pinback's head. He manages to hold on to the underside as it then ascends. Meanwhile, the alien discovers the faulty laser. Once again, bomb number 20 is lowered, and the main computer has to once again encourage it to return to the bomb bay. Talby is the only one that kind of picks up on like something's amiss, and he's concerned. So he goes to find out what's going on with the malfunctioning error, tries to tell Doolittle about it, but Doolittle's too distracted about surfing. Pinback manages to unfasten the trapdoor to the base of the lift, but he gets stuck trying to climb in. He randomly starts pressing buttons and is able to set off what will remove the floor plate via explosion.
Ooh.
Not a good move.
But he's fine. It's a Looney Tunes explosion.
It is.
You know?
That's right.
It's like the Wile E. Coyote.
It is, yeah. So he kind of comes out of it.
His hair's a bit ruffled. Yeah. There's birds flying above his head.
It may as well have gone that far. So he survives the ordeal and out the fury... grabs the tranquilizer gun, he fires it at the alien, which on impact from the dart deflates like a balloon.
As you would expect.
As you would expect. Pinback then tells the others of his ordeal. Doolittle and Boiler are disinterested with his encounter, and even more so when Pinback recounts a story that happened to him. This story just happens to be one he told them 4 years ago. Meanwhile, Talby investigates the faulty laser. So Pinbeck gets pissed off with the guys because they're not listening to him. He goes into the recording room, and this is where it's revealed that Pinbeck is actually a field technician named Bill. A series of interesting comments occur, and it's basically he ended up accidentally on the ship instead of the real Pinbeck, as I was alluding to earlier. Pinbeck makes a... He kind of makes more another recording about, and he complains about his mistreatment on the ship. And then we cut to the main computer telling of the damaged laser and not to send any bombs until it's fixed. The crew appear to ignore this and call on bomb number 20 to prepare for a bomb drop.
Fucking stoners.
Yep. God damn it. Talby tries to fix the laser but is blinded by the explosion. He walks in front of the laser and further explosions occur and everything shuts down.
He doesn't die.
He doesn't die. He's still alive.
It's
not a very good laser, is it?
I just thought for sure that was a fatal wound. But then he just shows up later on.
He does. It's interesting, isn't it? Like, I guess there's things that don't marry up.
But we're not. This isn't the film to.
It's not the film to judge on John Carpenter's writing.
Yeah.
Technicalities.
I think we're missing the point if we just pull apart those plot threads.
It's not even John Carpenter. It's Dan O'Bannon. So the crew are unaware that what's been going on with Talby, and they start to prep and prime bomb number 20 to explode. The bomb refuses to disarm, and the computer says she's heavily damaged and can only keep the explosion from inside the parameter.
Computer says no,
can't do it. At which point Doolittle declares that he will have to ask Commander Powell what to do. At which point I went, isn't he dead?
Hang on a minute.
I'm a Minutenbitter. and it's revealed that Powell has been cryogenically frozen.
Walt Disney style.
Yeah. Doolittle asks what they should do. And after a while processing about the issue, Powell recommends that Doolittle should teach the bomb phenomenology. Don't get me started on what that is. I kind of did read up on it, but it's kind of psychobabble. It's kind of like the meaning of life, kind of psychobabble, essentially.
Chicken and egg.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what Powell recommends that he does with the bomb. Doolittle puts on a spacesuit, ventures outside to reason with the bomb. He asks the bomb how it knows that it exists. Meanwhile, Boiler believes that he can stop the bomb by shooting at it.
He's kind of lost the plot at this point.
Lost it completely.
He's gone full Donald Trump.
Funny. Yeah, can you imagine? No, don't. He and Pinbeck have a fight as the latter believes that he is a poor shot. The bomb takes on board what Doolittle has said and decides to go back into the bomb bay to process these new ideas. Talby then wakes up in the airlift alive. Doolittle asks the guys to blow the seal on the emergency airlock so that he can get in. They do so, but Talby is blown out of the airlock in the process.
He gets Sandra Bullocked.
He does!
Big time.
And he has a conversation with George Clooney, who's not alive anymore. Spoiler! The bomb takes on board... I've totally lost myself. Doolittle asks the guys to blow up the seal, and so, as I said, Talby's jettisoned into space.
Quite comically.
Yeah. Pinbeck then tries to communicate with the bomb, but as he's chasing after... Because he sees Talby blowing away, so he is chasing after him in space, whilst also trying to talk to the bomb. The bomb believes that nothing exists in the world except him. His only means is to explode, so he declares, "Let there be light," and then explodes, taking the ship, Pinbeck, and Boiler with him, killing everyone, apart from Doolittle and Talby, who are floating in space. But because of the bomb, they kind of are blown in separate directions.
Mm. This is gravity, man. This is gravity.
That's it, man.
I'm telling you,
that's it.
Alfonso Cuarón took inspiration this scene.
The cryogenically frozen Powell is interestingly jettisoned also and floats off into space. We don't hear from him any further. Doolittle and Talby then talk as they drift further apart from each other. Talby is consumed eventually by the Phoenix asteroid, which he was talking about earlier. And he navigates, he's forever going to navigate the universe for eternity. which is fitting into his philosophy.
Yeah.
Doolittle then is left alone as he drifts towards a planet, knowing that he will burn up on entry. As he floats to certain doom, he comes across some ship debris, one of them which forms a surfboard shape. So Doolittle takes it upon himself to ride the last wave into the planet's atmosphere and his ultimate oblivion. We see him float downward until a flash of light signifies that he's dead.
Close Far credits. Out, man.
Close credits. Dude, did you just see what I just saw?
Yeah, you were riding that thing. Yeah, if you were taking it seriously up to this point, you'd certainly, at this moment, were going, oh, okay, right, I see what he's doing here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, we got to take this on face value. It is a university school project. They had the luxury of a few talents on board to kind of connect this thing together. In Dan O'Bannon, who definitely had the gift of the script, although this is, again, in its infancy, he would.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Dan O'Bannon. Like, he also plays Pinbeck in this. Mm-hmm. He co-wrote the screenplay. He's the film editor, production designer, and special effects guy behind this too. So he was very hands-on with the project.
Yeah.
5 years later, he would go on to write the screenplay for Alien. It would also write Blue Thunder, The Return of the Living Dead, Life Force, Invaders from Mars, Total Recall, and Screamers, to name but a few to his screen credits.
It's funny how there are elements of Alien in this, though.
He basically, like, he's come out and said, like, this was his kind of prototype for what Alien would be.
Yeah.
So he basically kind of took the core ingredients of what he was doing here and went, I'm going to do the same thing, but I'm going to move it into this territory.
It was the same idea of, it's almost like a space rig. It's like, they're like oil diggers, like in space kind of thing. It's like, it may as well be like driving a convoy through space.
Yeah.
But it dialed the tone. The tone was like all the way to the right into dark, nightmarish kind of material.
That's right.
This is very light and very
absolutely blank. Absolutely. So it's interesting having somebody like him on board, and then, you know, you couple that with John Carpenter, who was definitely a visionist, and from all accounts and what I've read about him and what people have said about John Carpenter, he's a doer, as in, like, he'll just get a project going and just start doing stuff and making things happen. So when you have that kind of combination, it's no surprise why this thing got made, first and foremost. Interestingly, what kickstarted it all for them, though, is that it just hit a certain note with a certain demographic of people.
Yeah.
And probably like-minded individuals like themselves who were just wanted a kind of a bit of a free ride, man, and just and it just hit a few kind of notes that tripped with a certain type of audience, as I said. What was your initial... This was your first time watching this movie.
Yeah.
What was your initial reaction to it when you were
I tried to go in not knowing much about it. The first time I heard about it was when Dan O'Bannon mentioned it in the... I think it was a documentary on Alien. Alien DVD.
Yeah.
He talked about this other film. So I was always curious to check it out. But I actually didn't know that it wasn't meant to be serious, as I mentioned, for like 10 minutes or so until I finally registered. And there was a point where I was like, the only point where I was like, man, this we just would hurry up, is the mentioned chasing scene.
Way too long.
But look, the stuff I made at uni, I would not want to go back and rewatch it. And I'm not saying that I've made stuff of the level of John Carpenter now, but my point is, like, you definitely learn from your mistakes and you improve over time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I wouldn't really put this in his official canon of... I mean, it is and it isn't. We're talking about all of his films, but...
No, that's right. And so just to remind people that are listening, like, so the idea of looking at John Carpenter, or even, like, as we did with Wes Craven, and we've looked at the early films, or we are looking at the early films for both of those auteurs, and that's purely to look at the journey that they would make and the impact that that would have when they come to make the classic films that they've become known for. So this is three movies away from what would be Halloween. You know, so it's important to kind of talk about this as far as his journey is concerned.
It's not going to be on the DVD shelf with the rest of the Carpenter films.
No.
I don't think I'll be adding it to my collection.
No.
But it's good to be a completist about these things. And
I agree,
and
see, yeah. I think
watch the director grow over the course of like all these films, which is why we're doing this.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. So from my point of view, I'm a huge fan of Carpenter, but I watched most of his other stuff before I came around to watching this one. And funnily enough, it was when I was at university that I would end up watching Dark Star for the first time. Because that university had an awesome film library, and I just took upon myself watching as much as I could when I had access to all that stuff. So, and this was one of them. And equally, I kind of, you know, it kind of suited the place I was watching it too. Just being in a university campus library in a private video booth, just watching on a TV, you know.
Yeah,
and I kind of like came out of it feeling a bit stoned in a darkened room.
If there was one place that was, you know, perfect to watch this, if they could say it on the poster, it's like best watched in a private viewing booth in a library. That actually fits quite well.
Yeah,
and it kind of close quarters, kind like the good men in the film.
Yeah,
just, you know,
it's very true. It's very true. So look, so that was kind of my reaction to it was a bit kind of, I felt a bit stoned coming out of it, really, because I've been in a confined space for an hour and a half with no lights, with no lights and no windows.
There was also the giant spliff that you had.
Yeah, it was the giant spliff in my hand too.
That could have been.
It was a bit of a giveaway. Yeah, you know me too well. So the other thing I'm just going to do is, I mean, there's not a lot of kind of, normally we would talk about the players of the piece. There's not a lot really to be said about the people, but just to kind of mention them by name. So we had Brian Norell would play Doolittle. Just a handful of credits to his name. Carl Kunholm would play Boiler. He had no other screen credits. And then
surprising.
Yeah, Dre, apart from Tash Twirler extraordinaire. And then we have Dre Pahish. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing these names right. He's the guy that would play Talby. His only other movie credit was in a film called Bloodbath. As I said, John Carpenter would actually dub over his dialogue with his own voice as well. And then, as mentioned, Nick Castle played the alien. So just a couple of, as I said, kind of comments around those guys. As far as the next section is concerned, we tend to gravitate to what I call the director's notes. It's just some things I've picked up or read about, whether they spark conversation or whether they're just fact pieces that I share with the guys. That's kind of it. As I said, John Carpenter would team up with Dan O'Bannon to write the screenplay with the film. It was basically a student film for the University of Southern California, just to be more specific. Talby's starsuit backpack is actually made from styrofoam packing material, and his spacesuit chest plate is a cake pan and a muffin tray.
This
is kind of the extent we're talking
brilliant
about.
Brilliant DIY.
The space helmets were part of Ideal Toys STAR Team toy line for young children, resulting in the snug fit on the adult actors' heads. They're quite
tightly
compacted.
They got Neil Buchanan from Art Attack to come in as an advisor on this film.
They may as well have.
All you got to do is get a bit of loo roll.
Bits of PVA glue. Yeah, it's great. And some sticky back plastic.
This is very an important art attack.
The double rows of large buttons that you see on the bridge consoles are actually ice cube trays illuminated from underneath.
I
think is awesome.
It is.
I love it.
You've got to. This is the stuff I want to know.
Yeah. So the home video cassette revolution was basically what kind of helped this one, you know, when it got released.
The stoner market.
Pretty much. And it's what Dark Star become a cult film among sci-fi films, sci-fi fans too, off the back of that. Carpenter himself described Dark Star as waiting for Godot in space. I think that's maybe trumping him a bit. I'm being a snob here because I've got a drama theatre background.
Yeah.
But Waiting for Godot, classic play by Samuel Beckett.
Piss.
Yeah, maybe he is.
Maybe, yeah.
Oh, let's give him the due that it,
I mean,
that's
I know
what he's doing.
The piss with the film, but maybe that comment itself is.
I get it though, because it is essentially, the whole kind of concept of waiting around for something to happen and then nothing happens. But by doing so, it results in their own failure.
Yeah.
So in that sense, yes, you could liken it to it.
And it's almost it's just funny how there's even the climax itself is a non-event.
Yeah.
Like they're just floating away, and it's like. Talby's asking him what happened to the men, and it's like, they're dead. It's like, yeah. They died.
Yeah.
There's no great, like, and there's no rising.
But that's the thing as well, because there's no the score or anything. Apart from those two characters at the end, Doolittle and Talby, there's no real connection with any of the crew either. Like, they don't. No,
you don't really know. Pinback at one point looks like he's the main character, and then
that's it. And then, so you're right. So in that sense, it maybe is in that sense easy to be dismissive of their demise because it's,
the film itself is unfocused. The same way that the characters are unfocused, the whole thing is just, I feel like it's all intentional.
Yeah.
Intentionally loose and...
Agreed. Agreed.
It all plays out in this kind of,
So the last thing I want to add, and it's funny that you mentioned Red Dwarf earlier, but Doug Naylor, who was one of the writers, so Rob Grant, Doug Naylor were the two guys that wrote Red Dwarf.
Mm.
Doug Naylor said in interviews that Dark Star was the inspiration for Dave Holland's Space Cadet, the radio sketches that evolved into the television science fiction situation comedy that would become be known as Red Dwarf.
That is not surprising.
No.
Yeah.
So it's funny that you pointed that out without me having to reference it.
Yeah. Well, I think that show is also intentionally, the sets are intentionally.
Originally. And that's where they went wrong when they came back and did all the new stuff. Because it got too nice looking.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's not, you know. They've got to be dirty and, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk about Red Dwarf as a, so I could be here forever. Final verdicts on the movie. Obviously if we're looking at this first venture into John Carpenter's, what would be his, he's going to start hitting some kind of home runs very soon off the back of this, but knowing that this was what started his career, what, any thoughts you want to add?
It's funny that this is the way he started his career because he hasn't really, he doesn't return to the sci-fi.
No. You could argue that Escape from New York does because it uses dystopian kind of future.
Yeah.
That's a very kind of loose way of crowbarring sci-fi to that.
Yeah.
I
mean, he's always been quite versatile. So even though he's known as the horror guy.
Yeah.
Like, he is prominently a horror guy. He's always said that he's also a big fan of Westerns.
And that kind of ties in a lot with his movies to come as well.
Yeah.
You see that. And he's a huge Howard Hawks
fan. But I think it's fair to say this movie stands apart from the rest of his body of work.
I'd agree. Would you recommend anyone to watch it?
Look.
What was that?
I wouldn't watch it again, I don't think.
Okay.
I wouldn't watch it again. But I would say if anyone really says that they're a Carpenter fan and they haven't seen all of his films... Like, it just gives you a bit more context when you're talking about him as a...
Yeah, I agree. I'll give you a bit of insight into me a little bit, and this might make me sound a bit of a pompous wanker, but I'm willing to wear that hat. I once
He's actually wearing a hat.
I am wearing pompous, a hat. It's pompous. It says pompous wanker on it.
He's just put it on just now.
Just for your benefit, Ben. But I went to I can't even remember where it was. I was a bit drunk, but I went to a bar in London, and there was jazz music playing, and in the background they had all these kind of like black and white. There was a huge canvas that had been stretched in the background of this wall, and they were showing these black and white images of jazz dancers, and it kind of got me. I was at university at the time, and I kind of struck a chord with me. I was like, "That's actually really cool. I like the idea of having music and just having something."
Yeah.
In the background. So then whenever I had a party at my house or my flat house that I would share with my other flatmates, I'd always put on a movie on in the background. We'd listen to have music, but there'd be a movie on in the background. This, for me, is a movie that you could put on in the background at a party and just have these weird images kind of floating by. Stick out. And that doesn't... say too much with the dialogue, I must admit.
There are certain films that I think do play well without audio and just pretty visuals to look at.
And I think this kind of lends itself to that a little bit because there's some farcical things that kind of happen in it, you know. Particularly the whole beach ball thing, you could just run that without any dialogue at all and have some crazy,
like I said,
techno music over the top.
Or
Benny Hill music. For that matter,
but that's another quote for the poster. That's best enjoyed projected on a wall at a warehouse party.
That's exactly it, man.
With no
that's
sound.
That's exactly what I think. And just put some funky music, like just put Carpenter's music over the top.
Yeah, just as the director intended.
Yeah, that's right. Look, so I think that's us. I think that concludes our discussions on Dark Star and concludes our horror surgery for what is our first John Carpenter early film discussion.
Taking our first step into a bigger world.
That's it. And it's only going to get bigger from here. The next discussion will be on Assault on Precinct 13.
Ooh.
The original.
Yeah.
It did have a remake. We're going to talk about that movie, and I believe, Ben, you're joining me for that one, and as is our dear friend, Anthony Yee.
I'm sure he'll have the synth queued up and ready to go.
I reckon he's going to be gunning to play some music for us.
I can already hear
him. He's down the corridor waiting. So that's it for us. Once again, thank you, Ben, for joining me.
Thank you.
And I'm your humble host, as always, Paul Farrell. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
You're listening to the Surgeons of Horror podcast.
John Carpenter.
The early years.
Dark Star.
Music supplied by Peter Nezick. For more discussions or podcasts, head over to surgeonsofhorror.com or head over to our Facebook and Twitter sites for the latest news and updates.